Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Vint Cerf to the broadcast. Widely known as one of the fathers of the internet, Vint is the co-designer of the TCP/IP protocol and the architecture of the internet. Vint was instrumental in the formation of ICANN and served as the organization's chairman from 2000 until 2007. Vint was also the founding president of the Internet Society and served in executive positions at MCI, the Corporation for National Research Initiatives, and at DARPA. Vint is currently Google's chief internet evangelist, a flexible role that allows him to support the development and continued spread of the internet, as well as the chairman of the People-Centered Internet, an organization he co-founded to ensure that internet access brings measurable benefits to the world. Vint has received numerous awards for his contributions to the internet, including the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom. Vint received a Bachelor of Science degree in mathematics from Stanford University and a Master's of Science degree and PhD in computer science from UCLA. I recently caught up with Vint at Google's offices in Washington, D.C., and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 2, infrastructure, as Vint discussed how he and Bob Kahn designed the protocols and architecture of the internet in the 1970s and 1980s, Principle 5, external partnerships, as Vint shared how the people-centered internet collaborates with governments, private sector companies, and other nonprofits around the world to maximize the positive impact of the internet. We also discussed milestones in the development and commercialization of the internet, Vint's focus on leveraging the internet to improve the quality of life for those in developing and disaster-ravaged regions, and Vint's concern around the harmful ways in which bad actors use the internet, among a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. Vint Cerf, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you. This is a pleasure to have my first on your podcast.
Well, thank you so much. Well, you are, to put it mildly, famous for a great number of things, but perhaps the one you are most famous for is being what some people refer to as the father of the internet, or at least one of the couple of parents of
thank
the internet.
Thank you for being careful about that. Bob Kahn and I had two hands on one pencil in the early designs. He deserves huge credit, as do thousands of other people since that time, maybe tens of thousands or even more. Because you don't do anything on this scale without a huge amount of willing collaboration and commitment.
Yes, and I would love to talk about that collaboration with Bob and with others, dating back to your time as one of the co-inventors of TCP/IP. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those early days and the inspiration, the genesis of those ideas.
Well, actually, to be really honest, we have to go back a little bit before TCP/IP. Mm. We have to go to UCLA. Where, as a graduate student, I worked with others on the ARPANET project, which is the predecessor to the Internet. It was a packet switching experiment, which ARPA put together in order to connect universities, a dozen of them, that were doing computer science and artificial intelligence research for the Defense Department. And the idea was to link all their computers together so they could share their resources, share computing capability, and in particular share their results, sometimes in the form of software, in order to make progress more quickly. And so the idea was to connect all these machines together, and the question was how to do that. The technology at the time was the telephone network, circuit switching, you know, dial a number, make a connection, send some data, and then hang up. It would have been too slow for the kinds of interactions that we were looking for. Packet switching, on the other hand, is more like electronic postcards. And they behave like postcards, too. You know, they get lost, they come out of order. You have to do a whole bunch of things to make a postal service work reliably. The same is true for packet switching. So we get the ARPANET running. Steve Crocker, who's then and now my best friend, led the network working group to develop the protocols to allow different brands of computers to communicate across this packet-switched ARPANET. And there were a number of other people who participated in the program. Then, after I finished my PhD, I went up to Stanford, and Bob Kahn, who was at the time at BBNN, Bolt, Baranek, and Newman, and was one of the key architects of the ARPANET packet switch. It was called an interface message processor. And there's a funny story about I think it was Ted Kennedy, who misunderstood that both Branek and Newman had gotten a contract for an interfaith message processor, and he congratulated them on their ecumenical effort. In any case, at Stanford, I started further research on computer networking. Bob Kahn, in the meantime, had left both Branek and Newman and joined DARPA and came out to my lab and said, "We have a problem." I said, "Well, what's the problem?" And he said, "Well, we're going to use computers for command and control because we think it will help us manage our resources better. But to do that, we're going to have to put computers in mobile vehicles, ships at sea, and airplanes, in addition to fixed installations. But you can't use wires to connect all these things together because the tanks run over the wires and they break and the ships get all tangled up and the airplanes can't get off the tarmac. So we're going to have to use mobile radio and satellite in addition to the dedicated telephone circuits that we were using to build ARPANET. The problem is these are all very different packet switch nets, different sizes, different speeds, different delays, and everything else. He says, how are we going to hook all these things together so they look uniform? So in the spring of 73, we started working on that problem. And by September or so, we had figured out pretty much how to do that. We had collaboration with members of what was then called the International Network Working Group, which is a collection of people from Europe, the U.S., Japan, and elsewhere, looking at computer networking and trying to sort out how to make it work. So by September, we had a pretty good idea. We wrote a paper, which was published in May of 1974, and we had begun detailed design starting in January of 74, before that paper was published, at Stanford. And so by the end of 74, we had a fully detailed specification for what was called Transmission Control Protocol, or TCP. The ensuing several years involved implementation and testing and discovery of mistakes and their repair. And so we iterated several times until we ended up around 1978 with a final specification, which we froze. By that time, we had split the Internet protocol off from the Transmission Control Protocol in order to deal with real-time communication that didn't require reliability but required timeliness. For example, radar communication, if you don't want to know where the missile was, you want to know where it is now. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to retransmit old information that isn't of any use. So we split the protocols into TCP and IP. We created something called User Datagram Protocol, which gave the users access to this real-time but possibly lossy communications channel. So that occupied my time, especially by 1978. I was already here in the Washington area working for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. We continued implementation across as many operating systems as we could, and then on January 1st, 1983, we turned the Internet on, which at that time consisted of approximately three networks: the ARPANET, the packet radio, mobile packet radio net in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the packet satellite net over the Atlantic. In addition to that, in May of 1973, Bob Metcalf David Boggs, had developed the Ethernet for their communication, the Alto machines or workstations. Very expensive, $50,000 workstations, but everybody at Xerox PARC had one. So that was yet another packet switch technology which was incorporated into the Internet architecture. And that was used for a lot of campus networks and things like that. So there was this fairly rapid growth in the academic community that DARPA supported. And without going into, another 20 years worth of stuff, the National Science Foundation picked up on this idea, funded the creation of the National Science Foundation Backbone Network, and about a dozen intermediate-level nets in order to connect 3,000 universities around the U.S. into this growing Internet system. And they contributed an enormous amount to the growth, absolute growth of the system, in addition to which they made some very important decisions that allowed the network to eventually become a commercial service. So NSF deserves a lot of credit for the evolution of the Internet as well.
Very interesting. Thank you for that overview. And I'm curious, at what point in that journey did you see the broader implications of what you were creating, the commercial implications, really the global implications of what would result?
So actually, there are several moments in time, milestones, I would say, that helped me understand the implications of all this. The earliest things actually were preceded the ARPANET, or the Internet. On the ARPANET in 1971, Ray Tomlinson came up with this idea of networked electronic mail, and it captured everyone's attention because it was so convenient to be able to communicate without both parties being awake at the same time, which meant that you could overcome time zone problems and everything else. That allowed us to undertake projects that, in fact, spanned over substantial geographic distances and didn't require people to be alert concurrently in order to cooperate with each other. We also saw the beginnings of the first mailing lists. One of them was called Sci-Fi Lovers, you know, because we were all geeks and we were all arguing who was the best science fiction writer. And there was another one from Stanford called Yum Yum, which was a restaurant review list. So we could already see in the 1970s, early 70s, the social effects that this technology might have. So already we're beginning to see that. Douglas Engelbart at SRI International had developed something called the Online System, which is a document production and sharing operation that included things like hyperlinking that let you associate one document with another. And in order to activate these hyperlinks, he had to invent a mouse which let you point to a place on the screen where the link was displayed so you could click on the link and go to the next document. So he's got a World Wide Web in a box, in effect, although he didn't call it that. So we're conscious of capabilities that this networking environment offered even before we started the Internet Project. As the Internet Project gets going, we're also thinking command and control. We're thinking video and audio as well as text and data would be needed in order to do command and control. So we were experimenting with packetized voice and packetized video in the mid-70s and early 80s. Not very much because there wasn't a lot of capacity, but we're already pursuing what we think of as commonplace today. So I have to say that technologically speaking, I think we were all fairly conscious of how powerful this could be. The commercialization was interesting because there's nothing commercial about the Internet. Until around the early 1980s, 84 or so, Cisco Systems suddenly decides that they should build routers because the normal way of making a router was to find a small computer and a graduate student and wrap the graduate student around the router or the computer and turn it into a router. But we were running out of graduate students. So Cisco started building routers and selling them commercially. Ethernet was already becoming a very popular local area networking technology. TCP/IP was made available on the Unix operating system, which is very popular, and that was done by Berkeley. Bill Joy wrote that software. And so we were starting to see a substantial growth in use of the technology. By 1988, I remember walking into an exhibition called Interop, which is started by Dan Lynch, a very good friend, who was also part of the early Internet development at USC ISI. He ran the computer centers there. He was up at SRI before that. So he's very much engaged in this environment. So I walked in with Eric Benamou, who was the CEO of 3Com at the time, a company that had been founded by Bob Metcalf. And I saw this two-story display from Cisco, and I remember turning to Eric saying, "Eric, how much do those cost?" And he said, $250,000. You know, I'm sort of shocked. And he says, "That doesn't count how much it costs to man the booth for a week." And so I just stood there thinking, holy moly, you know, Cisco must think they're going to make money out of this. And then I got to thinking, how are we going to get Internet in the hands of the general public? The government was the only source of support up until that time. So I began thinking, well, how do we light a commercial fire under the Internet to make it self-sustaining? And so this led me to wonder, you know, how we would make it apparent to the private sector that there might be a business offering Internet service, not just Internet software and equipment. Well, up until that point, the National Science Foundation and the other government agencies said, they didn't want any commercial traffic to flow on the backbones because, after all, these were government research and academic facilities. So I thought, well, how do we break that logjam? Well, in the interval from 1983 to 1986, I had stepped away from the Internet program and joined a company called MCI to build a commercial email service called MCI Mail. It wasn't the first email service. There were many others before that. And, of course, 71 is when email, network email, came along in the academic community. So I thought, by 86, I had rejoined Bob Kahn at a new company called Corporation for National Research Initiatives that Bob started after he left ARPA in late 85. So in 88, I thought, well, why don't we ask permission to connect the MCI mail system up to the Internet as a test to see whether we could get the protocols to work so that the two email services would interwork with each other. Of course, my ulterior motive was to try to break the logjam that said you can't have any commercial traffic on the Internet backbones. And the Federal Networking Council, which is the authority at the time, actually agreed to let us do that for a finite period of time. So we turned this capability on in 1989. And, of course, all the other commercial email providers, Telemail from Telenet and OnTime from TimeNet, CompuServe, and so on, said they wanted to have access to this too, and they got permission to do that from the Federal Networking Council. So they all got hooked up to the Internet, and now, of course, commercial traffic is flowing on the backbones. What shocked all of them, of course, is that the heretofore isolated and independent email services of CompuServe and Timeshare and Telenet were suddenly interconnected with each other through the Internet, and that meant that anybody on any of those services could actually communicate with anybody else because they were adopting the same protocols and formats that allowed this interoperability, which is sort of a surprise when you thought you had a sort of a trapped cohort of customers. Suddenly they could talk to everybody. But in the meantime, this triggered the development of three commercial Internet services. One of them was called UUNet, which was formed here in Northern Virginia. Another one was called PSINet, which was formed in New York, but they moved a center of operations here in Northern Virginia as well. And a third one out in Southern California called SurfNet, which was originally supposed to be SURFNet, but there was a problem with the name. Somebody else had taken it, so they changed it to CERFNet because it sounded the same. And then they asked me if it was okay to do that, and I finally decided, well, okay, it isn't. Just don't screw it up. I don't want to be embarrassed. So we had three commercial Internet services coming in 1989. So for me, I would say that 1988 moment was probably the most important. Some of my colleagues thought it was a crazy idea to commercialize this. I mean, why would you let the unwashed masses into your sandbox? But I thought it would be useful for people to have access to this system. Now, of course, this predated the development of the World Wide Web, which begins somewhere around 89 and becomes visible out of CERN from Tim Berners-Lee in 1991. And again, after he announced and released this first version, I think not too many people noticed. But Marc Andreessen and Eric Bina at the National Center for Supercomputer Applications saw this idea and added their own idea, which is a graphical user interface to the Internet, which they called Mosaic. So the Mosaic browser was an absolute hit. Everybody was stunned by the idea that the Internet could look like a magazine with formatted text and imagery and eventually, of course, streaming audio and video. So this really galvanized everybody's recognition of potential, especially, for example, advertising. Jim Clark, who was the founder of Silicon Graphics, also a DARPA initiative because the geometry engine that he developed at Stanford was at the heart of the Silicon Graphics computer systems for rendering, graphics rendering. So Jim recognizes instantly that there are huge possibilities in this Mosaic thing, goes out and brings Marc Andreessen and Eric Bina and others to the West Coast to start Netscape Communications. They get started in 94. They go public in 95. The stock goes through the roof. The dot boom is on. And, you know, everybody is throwing money at anything that looks like Internet. Until April 2000, that's the dot bust. But even after that, the network continued to grow very, very rapidly because the underlying service functionality of it was very attractive. So those are the sorts of milestones from my point of view, especially the introduction of the World Wide Web, that induced a huge content to flow into the network from people who just wanted to share what they knew. And the astonishing thing is that they didn't care to be compensated for this. They just wanted to know that this information was useful for somebody else. It is one of those altruistic, amazing events. Of course, now this ocean of content is in the net, and nobody can find anything. So now we have browser search engines popping up, like Alta Vista, Lycos, Yahoo, eventually Google, Bing, and others. And so you could sort of see these stages being induced. You know, the consequences of a previous development inducing the next one that's needed. And so, of course, now this is big business across the net. So I could see these events occurring and unfolding. I couldn't predict them all. The most interesting one, though, comes in 2007 when Steve Jobs introduces the smartphone, the iPhone. And at this point, this is a kind of old technology in the sense that mobile phones had been around for a while. Marty Cooper was the guy that did the first mobile phone for Motorola. It was a big, you know, about 8 inches tall with a whip antenna on top, weighed about 2.5 or 3 pounds. He did started that work in 73, same year that Bob and I started working on the Internet. He turns it on in 83, which is when we turned the Internet on. These two technologies go in parallel. But by 2007, when Jobs comes up with a smartphone that can do Internet, suddenly the two technologies combine. They don't collide. They combine and become mutually reinforcing, which is a really powerful phenomenon. The Internet becomes more accessible thanks to the smartphone. The smartphone becomes more useful because of access to all the content and functionality of the Internet. So these two things together are almost hypergolic. And the result now is a much larger fraction of the population of this planet have access to the net that they would not have had if we had to wait for wireline termination points in various homes. Now it's wherever you can reach a base station. So those are the kinds of milestones for me that are sort of mark progress and reinforce my belief that there was a huge business to be made out of this vast infrastructure.
It's extraordinary. You've hit a number of mile markers, and appreciate that overview. One of the things I've found extraordinary in researching your career is the number of fields in which you had influence. You were an academic, which is where a lot of the initial research for the early phases of the Internet happened. You joined DARPA. You were involved in the government, brought you here to Washington, where we are today. MCI, one of the early early commercial iterations of the Internet. And then you get involved in the founding of ICANN. You get involved in 2005 and join Google. And I'm curious with... And you had this enormous ecosystem around you as a result of the contacts you were building, the influence you exerted in each of the places that I've just mentioned. And one of the things I'm so curious about is how have you decided where to put your time? You've been involved in so many interesting places, and one can't, especially some of the affiliations you've had, one can't question the you know, the choices you've made in joining, you know, a number of organizations that have had themselves enormous influence. But how have you kind of managed your career in that way?
You can tell if you parse this carefully, you realize that I'm incapable of doing more than one thing at a time, unlike many of my colleagues. And so I try to make everything about the Internet. So no matter what I did, it was something now related to the Internet. Even the MCI mail system took advantage of the email developments out of ARPANET and Internet and tried to commercialize that, and then I hooked them together. So the institutions with which I have become affiliated at one time or another have all had some connection with it, whether it's chairmanship of ICANN and participating in the creation of ICANN in the late 1990s, the chairmanship of the America's Registry for Internet Numbers is about IP address allocation. I served on the Internet Architecture Board and sort of created its predecessor, the Internet Configuration Control Board, served in the Internet Engineering Task Force in one way or another as a working group chair, for example. So in almost every step of the way, even coming to Google was clearly related to Internet, because Google wouldn't exist if there weren't a platform on top of which the World Wide Web could run. I mean, Tim has been very clear, Tim Berners-Lee, that if there hadn't been an Internet available, it's not clear whether the World Wide Web idea would have propagated very far, because he would have had to create that infrastructure, and that might have been a challenge. But he didn't have to because it was already there. So that's what's good about infrastructure. It's there, and then you use it. So you can see this theme shows up virtually in all cases. And in fact, even my connection with NASA has an internet component to it, because back in 1998, my team at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory started talking about how do we build an interplanetary extension of the internet. And so once again, you can see how this is all connected. So it's actually shows you, you know, how simple-minded I am. I can only do this one thing. This is an internet thing, and everything else is sort of associated with that, including digital preservation, which is another huge problem. I'm worried about the trillions of photographs that get taken that won't be visible, you know, 10 years or 20 years from now, because either the equipment where they're stored isn't readable anymore, or we don't know how to interpret the bits to make them a nice image. We need to work on that. I don't mean to go into a half-hour rant, but I mean, again, this is sort of associated with the internet, because I don't think we'd be using, we wouldn't be taking pictures and writing documents and tweeting and doing all the blogging and what have you if there weren't this underlying infrastructure of the web and the internet. And so now the preservation of all that digital content is a consequence of its existence, invited by this existing infrastructure.
Very interesting. And I do want to linger on your role as chief internet evangelist at Google, a role you've had since 2005, so a little bit more than a dozen years now. And we're actually meeting in the DC office of Google. How much time do you allocate to that role, and what does it entail ultimately?
Well, the simple answer might be anything that I decide looks like it's important. But the honest answer to this is that part of my task here is to do whatever I can to create conditions under which more internet infrastructure can be built, which means I need to go where it isn't in order to try to find a way to make that happen. And although you might think it's obvious, of course you should build internet infrastructure. Are you crazy? You know, why wouldn't you do that? As we go to, let's say, weaker and weaker economies, where affordability is a very big issue, we need to help to create not only business models, but also, legal environments and business environments that invite investment, that provide for a return, but also make the internet useful for people. So just spreading the physical access to the net is part of the job, but making that access now useful to people locally, wherever they happen to be, is equally important. Otherwise, why would they ever subscribe to access to it? So a lot of my time is spent talking to governments and their representatives about policy having to do with making the internet more available to people. And to be quite honest with you, at the same time, we also have to cope with the fact that the internet allows some things to happen that we all wish didn't happen. This is a direct consequence of, an objective that we had, the consequences of which I didn't fully appreciate at the time. I thought pushing the barrier to access to the internet and the World Wide Web and content down to nearly zero was a good thing, because it made it easy for people to share what they knew and to get access to that which is shared. And so this low barrier, I thought, was really important. And indeed, it helped to create this influx of content. What I hadn't fully appreciated, probably because at the time I was an engineer and a geek and didn't think about why anybody would use this infrastructure for bad stuff, we end up with everybody in the world, well, half of them anyway, capable of injecting content into the net. Well, some of that content is harmful. Some of it's, you know, things like bullying or cyber malware, denial of service attacks, fraud. These are not all new. We could commit fraud in the postal mail or on the telephone or face-to-face, but the internet allows quite a bit of escalation and scaling that you wouldn't otherwise get. So spam, for example. Creating a zero barrier to spam was probably not the best idea in the world, and yet we would never give up our free email, would we? So we have this problem. So now we have to figure out what policies can be adopted and enforced that will protect people from some of the harmful side effects of this global infrastructure. Well, this is difficult to do because the internet was designed to be insensitive to national boundaries. I mean, I was proud of that, actually. And it was driven, in fact, by the fact that this was supposed to be a military command and control system. You didn't want to have to go to country X and say, hi, I need some address space from you because we're planning to invade in the next 2 weeks and I can't run my command and control system without it. So we had to make this insensitive to national boundaries, which it is. So now we have the problem that a perpetrator can be in one jurisdiction and the victim in another, and those could cross national boundaries. So the question is, how do we collaborate not only to create the internet, which is a grand global collaboration, but how do we also collaborate in order to make the internet a safer and more secure and more trusted environment? And that's going to require policy collaboration among countries. Well, this is not so easy, partly because there are different views of content in different parts of the world. Some authoritarian regimes see freedom of expression as a dangerous and harmful side effect of this kind of infrastructure as opposed to a beneficial and constructive one. And so finding a way to achieve some common views about protecting people from potential harm in the internet is a non-trivial exercise. But in a way, I've come to the conclusion that it was collaboration that got us into this situation. It's collaboration that may help us make the situation better. And so that's a big focus of my attention as chief internet evangelist, is trying to figure out how to make this a safer and more secure and, to the extent possible, a more private environment. Privacy is very hard to come by these days, as you may know, and figuring out how to cope with that is a non-trivial exercise.
Yeah, that's interesting. And some of what you just described also commingles with some of the mission and purview of the People-Centered Internet, an organization that you co-founded recently. And I wonder if you could take a moment just to describe that organization and its mission.
I really appreciate the opportunity to do that. A woman named Mei-Lin Fung, who's out in Palo Alto, she's an MIT graduate. She was at Oracle and was one of the key people developing the notion of customer relationship management, CRM. And so she actually came to me with this idea. She had already started working in this space, trying to make the internet more useful for people in a measurable way. I mean, not simply in a philosophical way, but in some way to show that their lives were better. Did they have more income? Did their health improve? Did they have a more coherent ability to find work? There were a whole series of potential measures that she was trying to identify in order to assure that, that the effort that was going into creating internet infrastructure actually produced benefits for people. And I thought that it was a very compelling argument. It's one thing for an engineer to say, we got to go build some more roads. Something else to say, by the way, we put cars on the roads, they shouldn't run into people.
Right.
And so as we tried to think our way through ways to achieve that objective, at some point, David popped up on the horizon.
David Bray.
And much to my astonishment, agreed to become our executive director. And so we owe him enormous thanks for having taken that on. So our purpose is to find projects that could materially improve people's use of the internet, whether it's creating information in local languages or providing services that improve their ability to find jobs or work or their economic stability or their safety or their health. And so we're looking for those opportunities. Of course, we're also looking for ways of funding efforts like this. More recently, various catastrophic events have drawn our attention, one in the Santa Rosa, Napa Valley, Sonoma area. The major wildfires there have put many people out of their homes. They've lost all of their identification papers and everything else. It's a very difficult recovery. And, of course, the storms in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, to say nothing of Haiti, have done untold damage for all practical purposes, massive devastation, very, very difficult to recover from. Power and other infrastructure just completely gone. Communications completely gone. So we've been focusing on what, if anything, could PCI do to facilitate improvement and recovery in Puerto Rico. One thing I would point out is that David and I both have this technological genetic component to us. And if we're going to rebuild something, instead of just building the old thing, we'd like to build the new thing, which makes it better, makes it more resilient. So the next storm that comes along, which is bound to happen, the system will be able to weather the storm better than it could in this past one. So we're looking at, you know, new technologies and new architectures, and maybe more distributed power generation, better communications. So that's driving us right now at PCI, is to look for opportunities to facilitate some of these improvements where we can. We can't do everything ourselves. We're a very tiny little organization, but we're well connected. And so we might be able to find places that want something to happen, places that can afford to pay for something to happen, and then people can actually do it and get them all hooked together and actually cause a good thing to happen. Mm. And that would be very satisfying for us.
Excellent.
Vint, is someone who was heavily involved in the creation of a technology that has impacted the lives of literally billions of people, I wonder, as you look to the future, what technologies are you most excited about?
Well, I like the word excited, because it could mean, you know, that exactly, you're excited right. Because it's really terrific, or you're excited because, holy moly, what are we going to do?
That's right.
And I have to say that this avalanche of software-controlled devices, otherwise known as cyber-physical systems or Internet of Things, really does have my attention, and I am very worried about it, because as a former programmer, I know it's very hard to write software that doesn't have bugs, and so there are several issues. One of them is that if a bug shows up, something may not work properly. Could be quite unexpected, could be fairly innocuous, or it could be devastatingly serious. I mean, a self-driving car with a bug in the software could, you know, do a lot of damage. Even your household security system with a bug in it could cause a lot of trouble. So I'm worried about the fact that we will be surrounded by buggy software. We already are. We carry it around in our hands and our mobiles and our laptops and tablets. But now it'll be inside of us, theoretically sensing our conditions, but what if they get it wrong? Then it raises the question, how do we write better software? What environment should we have to avoid bugs? But second, when we find the bugs, what do we do about them? Can we update the software in these various devices? And this leads to the next question, how does the device know that the software that it's getting is from the legitimate source and it hasn't been altered in some way? So how can I be assured of the source and the integrity of the software? And by the way, how do I even get the software to this embedded device, wherever it happens to be? There are a whole series of issues associated with trying to make the Internet of Things a safe and trusted environment, or trustable environment. We're far from having answers to all that. And so this keeps me up at night, because I can see motivations for creating these products and getting them out the door, but not enough motivation for paying attention to maintaining them and assuring their functionality over the period of time, a lifetime, that they're likely to be used. When you start thinking about large products in a home, for example, the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, these are not things you replace with any frequency. It's not like a mobile that you might replace every year or 2 years or 6 months or whatever. So I'm very concerned about the ecosystem associated with the Internet of Things and the side effects that it might have on the way our lives work. So I'm very excited about that. Mm-hmm. I see big potential, lots of possibilities for applying artificial intelligence and machine learning, but also some concern.
This is a sort of an interesting paradox of our time, that there is unparalleled, and one might argue, a faster pace to innovation than ever before, but also the risks associated with them, one might argue also, are greater than before. And so this holding in the balance, sort of pushing forward into the brave new world, but also bearing in mind, maybe putting a slight governor on it, at least to contemplate the security implications, the broader societal implications, becomes that much more important as well. Do you agree?
I certainly agree with that. And one thing I can tell you is that computer scientists and engineers often do not have the capacity to fully imagine the implications of the technology they develop. I saw a little piece recently about Gibson, who wrote Neuromancer, among other. Did I have that right? Yeah. Gibson was the one who coined the term cyberspace. He didn't actually understand very much about the technology, but he imagined what you might do with it. And so his writings, in a sense, supplemented the understanding and the ability of the engineers to foresee some of the things that have happened. In fact, he was spot on for a lot of it. Many of us didn't anticipate the harmful potential of these technologies. So this leads me to a sense of ethical concern that people responsible for creating those products, writing the software, and so on, should feel a great burden, a greater one than is typical, to be thoughtful and careful about what they do and how they do it and how well they do it because of the potential scaling side effects of mistakes that they might make. I think not only do the individuals have to feel this ethical pressure, but the companies need to have incentives to, in fact, assure to the best of their ability that these bad things don't happen.
Well, Vintserv, it's been an honor to spend a little time with you today. Thank you for joining me on the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join us next week when my guest will be Barry Eggers, the co-founder and managing partner of Lightspeed Venture Partners. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.